Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Media.
Hello and welcome to Cool People Did Cool Stuff, your weekly reminder that sometimes people do things about the bad things. I'm your host, Margaret Killjoy, and my guest today is Molly Conger. Hi, Molly.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. I wrote down as your bio, rather than looking at what your bio is elsewhere, the famed socialist dog mom of Twitter, an investigator of far-right extremism, and a city council aficionado, as well as the reason that I now know I don't know how to spell aficionado.
Yeah, that about covers it.
Excellent. Well, oh, I have to do the rest of the introductions as if other people matter. I mean, hi, Sophie.
Wow.
That's the meanest I've ever done that.
That
I'm
was
sorry.
Spicy.
I feel bad. There's no going back.
That's usually much warmer.
I demand a compliment.
Sophie is great.
I'll take it.
Sophie has good interior design, but I can't tell you about it, dear listener.
My plants are doing really, it's really
I was
sunny.
About to mention the plants.
They're doing really well right now.
They're really thriving.
They feel alive and well, which is better than I do.
Also, Sophie has helped my skincare game.
Love
that. I'm super excited to be the podcast idiot, which is a title that I made up for the person who receives the information. It's, you know, it's big shoes to fill. I've looked up to a lot of podcast idiots in the industry, and I'm excited to try it.
I believe in you.
Molly said that in one of our Cool Zone meetings, and I was like, does anybody want to be the podcast idiot? And I go, at Cool Zone Media, we call that the Sophie.
Well,
I know I wanted a hint about the topic, but I did not receive one. So I'm going in full idiot.
We only give hints when it's like sketchy enough that we have to be like.
That's what I said. That's what I told him.
I was like, if I'm about to talk about someone who's like currently under investigation as like a terrorist, I usually have to be like, hey, is this okay? You know, but none of these people are. Also not currently under investigation for terrorism is our audio engineer, Danil. Hi, Danil.
Hi, Danil.
We can't move forward until everyone says hi to Danil, unfortunately.
I love Danil. Danil's given me a lot of help in my my new podcasting journey, so I really appreciate Danil.
He's the best.
Excellent. Our theme music was written for us by Unwoman. So, I knew I was going to have you on, and then I was like, who am I going to talk about? And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I stared at my bookshelf. And then I realized there are these people that have you ever heard of the provos of Amsterdam? These are not the provos of Ireland.
Oh, no. The provos of Ireland, yes. The provos of Amsterdam, no.
Entirely different etymology. Came before the provos of Ireland.
And not Provo, Utah.
Also not Provo, Utah.
And not provolone cheese. Okay, I'm ready.
Yeah, entirely different etymology than all of those things. There's a remarkable amount of provo that one could etymologize. Okay, have you ever heard of the kabouter?
No.
Okay.
I'm ready to learn.
Excellent. What if I told you that during the late 60s and early 70s, while countercultural movements all over the West were kicking off, right? We've talked about a lot of them on this show. The Dutch had a version. Everywhere had a version of this. The Dutch had a few versions of it, and they had their own unique spin on things. The counterculture of the Netherlands centered around a group of pranksters, anarcho-pacifists, and anarcho-city council members.
Oh, hell yeah.
So I got really excited to bring you on for this one.
Undoing the system from inside.
We'll talk about it. I'll be curious your take on this. And they built a thriving and politically engaged counterculture. They brought organic food into the cities. They started the squatting movement in the modern sense that redefined Dutch life for generations and brought a lot of attention to the housing crisis. They demanded human accessible urban infrastructure, and they scared the shit out of the monarchy. And they called themselves gnomes.
That's adorable.
Because kabouter is a word for gnome.
Did they have like the little pointy hats?
They didn't wear them, but the ones that they used as their symbol absolutely did. Actually, the pointy hat comes from the kabouter gnome. It comes from the Dutch gnome. The book gnome, the illustrated book that all the Western gnome stuff comes from, was originally called kabouter in the original Dutch.
I'm going to choose to believe that all the old people in town who have like a little lawn gnome are sort of secretly signaling their interest in Dutch counterculture.
I think that they are. And I think that you can just expect that they will respond favorably if you act. Well, actually, this group of counterculture is really nice to old people. That was one of my favorite parts. But we're going to get to that. That's coming. So we're going to talk about the provos and we're going to talk about the kabouters. Two distinct groups that are not actually incredibly distinct, but they are at different times. And because it's this show, I'm going to talk about the Netherlands. The Netherlands, the first time I decided to move to the Netherlands 20 years ago, and my grandfather looked at me with a wink and he said, ah, because of the lady in the picture windows, which was a reference to the famed legalized sex work of the Netherlands.
Racy grandpa.
Yeah, it was actually the sketchiest thing my grandpa's ever said to me. My uncle looked at me and made a little like toque gesture, you know, holding his fingers up to his lips, a reference to the decriminalized weed that the country is also famous for. However, my friends knew why I was actually moving there. The legal squatting that the country was only famous for in pretty much my social circle. But I was a squatter, so the Netherlands was famous to me. Like my friends who had lived there before would come back with these like wild stories about, you know, these huge squat actions and fighting back the cops and all the fun, crazy stuff. And I was like 21. So I was like, this is where I'm going. Have you ever been to the Netherlands? You know much about it?
I have not. I've been to Germany, but I didn't get much further than that.
It's okay.
I mean, honestly, when you said they were fighting back against the monarchy, I forgot they had that. I forgot we were still doing that. So no.
That's on my short list of contacts I was about to say about the Netherlands. The things that are worth knowing about the Netherlands for this story. One, it is the most densely populated country in Europe that isn't like an island or a specific city state, you know? Because Europe has a lot of like countries that are a city.
Monaco, Vatican yeah. City, Luxembourg.
Yeah, Liechtenstein. Those things. Yeah,
little
those
guys.
Are
yeah.
Those are more densely populated than Netherlands. But as far as like normal ass countries go, no offense if you're listening to this in one of those city states. Actually, I think city states are cool, whatever.
It's okay to offend the people of Monaco.
Okay, yeah.
It's just great. A casino, isn't it?
I know even less. You could tell me almost anything about Monaco and I would believe you. Second thing to know about the Netherlands, it's a monarchy still.
Still doing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had this moment once. I was there 10 years ago or something. And I was like hanging out with my friends. And I'm like in this square and there's this giant picture of the Queen Beatrix, who's in this story, actually. And I like look and I'm like, God, sometimes I forget that y'all are a monarchy.
It's so embarrassing.
And then my friend's like, yeah, you're a police state. And I was like,
okay, we'll get our ass right. Then. Sure.
All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. So it's a monarchy. It's also a colonial power and had a large empire at some point. It's kind of the also-ran of the Western European empires. And then fourth, I lived there for like 7 or 8 months and I spent a lot of time trying to learn Dutch and or just pronounce Dutch words. And I was
impossible.
A colossal failure at both. And I'm going to continue my streak here. So
No, it just looks like somebody was trying to type in German, but they got blackout drunk and someone hit them in the hand with a mallet and all of their fingers are broken.
I know, but the pronunciation is so much more fun than German. Like, German is like, everything sounds like I'm going to murder you and everyone that you've ever met. And everything in Dutch sounds very nice.
Like a little no. Said it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Netherlands has long been a place that prides itself on religious tolerance compared to other places in Europe. A lot of people fleeing persecution wound up there, which including like whenever the Protestants and the Catholics. And I mean, it's obviously not perfect, right? But it's been a thing for a while, which means that a lot of Jews lived there. Then the Nazis occupied it in World War II and the Dutch resistance kicked in. And it was one of the countries that had a very different style of resistance to the occupation than a lot of other countries. It was one of the most resistant countries. We did a whole episode about the gay art movement there that burned Nazi records and forged IDs and blew shit up. If people want to go listen to the gay resistance to Nazis episode.
Hell yeah.
And over a million people were involved on some level in aiding like Jews escape the Holocaust. However, they were not incredibly remarkably successful at this, despite the large scale of it. One of the reasons for that is that the Dutch resistance movement was less violent than many other resistance movements. This is going to come up. This shapes the culture of what we're going to talk about. As for why the Dutch resistance culture was less violent, I was like, oh, it's because the Dutch are all pacifists. Because the people I'm going to talk about today are fairly pacifist, right? So far, I've found when I look up why the Dutch resistance movement was a less violent movement overall, one of the reasons, according to one of the participants, was that the Dutch had a firearms registry. And so when the Nazis took charge, they got the firearms registry and they went door to door and took everyone's guns away.
Oh, God, Alex Jones was right in the past.
So one of the things that comes up when I read all of this is that, like, all of these things that, like, right-wing militias are afraid of here are true for the left and are not true for the right, you know, or have been in various places and times.
Right, like the guy you look up to actually did do that thing you're afraid of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, like, overall, the right-wing collapse. Well, there were a lot of Dutch monarchists who actually fought in the resistance, too. There was right-wing resistance to fascist occupation in some places, although overall. But, no, whatever. I'm not trying to give too much credit to the
monarchists.
I guess
resisting Hitler in the name of the king, like, you know, you got the spirit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you know,
you got the right answer.
Yeah. Yeah, you get this, like, kind of, you get a little bit of this, like, patriotic, like, don't fuck with our Jews. And I'm like, you know what? It could be as patriotic as you want, as long as the core message is we will shoot the people who are trying to kill the Jewish people. That's fine. Anyway, the Nazis collectively punished the Dutch people, which I'm sure will have no bearing on. More than a million people were directly involved in supporting this resistance, right? So the Nazis cut off food. From November 1944 to May 1945, more than 20,000 Dutch people starved to death. This is called the Hunger Winter. Especially elderly men starved to death during this period. 4.5 million people were affected by this starvation. They were living off of like 600 calories a day, which is a third of what you need if you're not doing much. An entire generation of children born or living at the time suffered lifelong ailments. And this is going to be, when we talk about these like peaceful hippies in this modern consumer culture, this is what they were born from. This is what their childhoods were. Audrey Hepburn grew up in the occupied Netherlands and
that's right.
And actually supported the resistance when she was like a teenager by performing ballet to raise money to support the resistance, which is fucking cool. Her time in the hunger winter left her with lifelong ailments like anemia. So in case anyone wants to think about what's happening in Palestine right now, I leave the comparison to you about what mass starvation does to an entire generation, including the people who survive. So the war ends. Like in most of the West, you've got this very conservative couple of decades. You have to, after this enormous hardship and poverty, then you get like consumerism and rising wages of the 1950s. And then you get the 60s. The 60s hit the Netherlands, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Counterculture, all that stuff. When I first started doing this podcast, I was like, oh God, I'm going to end up having to do all of these different 60s counterculture movements. And I was like, kind of like, And then the more I read about them, I'm like, oh no, there's like, they're all different. They're all cool. Some of them suck, whatever. They're all interesting, you know?
No, but the children of, you know, the people who are coming of age in the 60s in the Netherlands had such a different childhood experience than, you know, American hippies coming of age after not surviving an occupation.
No, totally. And like a lot of the people who are going to be talking about today, a lot of them grew up either hiding Jews in their house, being the Jews who are hidden in houses. There's a lot of like Jewish orphans who are raised by non-Jewish families because for reasons that become clear. No, it is. It's a very interesting thing. But you also compare with like the Netherlands is the colonial core and it is a primarily white country. And so there are some people of color who are coming from basically from the colonies, right?
Where are the Netherlands called? Like Southeast Asia? Like Sri Lanka? Indonesia?
Parts of Southeast Asia, parts of the Northeast, South America, and South Africa, but South Africa before the British took it. I'm not actually as... I need to like learn more about the Boer Wars and all that stuff that happened, because a lot of the origins of modern fascism grow up in South Africa and Rhodesia and shit, you know?
Yeah, that just keeps coming up. It just won't die.
Yeah, I wish it would. Like, you lost the war, get over. Oh, right. I've lived in the American South. Anyway, because of the fact that the Netherlands colonial core, like a lot of the 60s culture in the US is, especially the radical culture, is in relation to the civil rights movement, is in relation to the wild amount of racism and the fact that, you know, it is a colonized space, right? And so I actually think that some of the anarcho-pacifism, the pacifist part of that, that's going to come up. I actually think that that's a relation to the way that power works in their country as compared to like the United States, where people of color fighting for their rights largely distanced themselves from pacifism by the end of the late 60s, at least in terms of the larger social movements. Anyway, the first subculture in the Netherlands to shatter this post-war tranquility was called the Nozem. They were the Dutch greasers. And so it's cool. It's like half of who we're going to be talking about, instead of it's hippies, it's greasers.
So it's like sharks and jets.
Yeah, basically.
But like with gnome hats.
Yeah. Just imagine everyone in a gnome hat. No one's actually wearing a gnome hat, but you should imagine them all in gnome hats. They came in on the scene in the mid-50s. 1955 is when they get their name. A year or two before that, they started doing their thing. They wore jeans and they wore leather jackets and they listened to rock and roll, And they drove around. They listened to Western pop music. And they drove around on mopeds and shit. And their name comes from another cool thing about Dutch history. Thieves Cant. You ever played like Dungeons and Dragons or any of that shit?
No, I'm a sore winner and a sore loser, so I don't really like games.
Oh, okay. Well, see, I don't like competitive games, and that's actually why I like tabletop role-playing games. But anyway, Thieves Cant is this other language that thieves use. And generally speaking, the word Thieves Cant comes from the British version of this. The version of it that's in the Netherlands is called Barhoons. The guttural H that no one... I actually gave up trying to learn Dutch because I would try to learn the difference between these things and no one could understand. So
it's like crime code.
Yeah, it's the language of the criminal underworld. And it has some like older, like late medieval, early modern kind of origins, but it's especially about 1850 to 1950 and kind of the mafia, like kind of criminal underworld. But some of also the more cool criminal underworld. Criminals, vagabonds, and traveling salespeople spoke it in the 17th century. And a lot of it comes from Yiddish, which is cool. And I feel like Yiddish is slowly making its way into cool people bingo, and that makes me happy. So the Nozem, it gets translated as a greaser, or it gets translated as beatnik. They had another cool name, which they actually had before Nozem. They were the Dykers.
All right, I'm in.
I know. Imagine getting to wear a black leather jacket and ride around on a moped with your friends, often multiple people per moped, and be called a diker.
You know, they're known for their dikes.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, it's because the dikers hung around some of the areas of Amsterdam with dikes, like Nieuwendijk. They were like, everyone's like subculture name here is just like whatever part of Amsterdam they hung out in. So it was like, instead of sharks and jets, it's like those fucking Leidsupliners. Actually, we're going to talk about the Leidsupliners.
It's
in
like,
a
you know, Bowery Boys or whatever, you know, it's like whatever part of town.
Totally. Oh, Bowery Boys is a good, that is the way to, yeah. A journalist gave them the name Novzum in 1955, and they were like, yeah, fuck it, whatever. That sounds cool. Yeah, we're like crime, whatever. We don't care. And the ones who hung out near Leidsaplein were the artsy ones. And so they were the Pliners. In 1965, an academic noting the provocative behavior of all these youth cultures started calling them provos. And so unlike the Provisional IRA, which gets the provos, which gets its name from provisional, in this case, they get their name from provocative. So, and the provos are like, yeah, fuck yeah, we're provos. We're into it. Like, whatever. It was meant as a pejorative, but they didn't care. And this is 4 years before the Provisional IRA. I don't know why I'm so into like pointing out that this is the original provos, but here I am.
The hipsters of being provos. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. They're completely unrelated, but it makes it harder for me to like...
Very different number of rifles.
Absolutely. Very different number of rifles. Yes. They don't have songs like My Little Armalite. They have songs about like, we are cuckoo birds and the owls are up above us.
Oh, it's a whole different Provo vibe.
It is. It is. Although if you put the two together, anyway, and there's a couple of these provos who are very important to our story. One of them is named Robert Jasper Hrutfeld, and he is not going to look good to today's audience for some specific reasons. The Netherlands has had a bunch of colonies, right? And one of those from a good long time ago is South Africa. And so a lot of Dutch people would like go visit South Africa, right? And so when he was a kid, I think, Robert went to South Africa and he got super into it. He became obsessed with African magic.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And he was a Pliner. He was one of the artsy weirdos of this growing Provo subculture. He was also a total wingnut who was not afraid to do weird shit. And so he started the big political thing at this time. This is before they really got like politics. They were just against consumer culture. They were like, we don't like this stuff, this consumer culture that we're, you know, being sold. And he had one primary target. And whenever you look up this man, he is referred to as an anti-smoking activist. That is his single issue.
He was early on the scene with that one.
Absolutely. It is really fascinating to me. Smoking is big corporations and consumerism trying to kill you, he argued. He is right. He's against it. I don't disagree. He also smoked constantly.
So he knew what he was up against. You know, he was absolutely getting to know the enemy.
He referred to it as being a witness to the darkness.
This is like where half of Mad Men got their inspiration. They basically did like the entire thing about doing ads for the tobacco industry while all chain smoking. And then they had like the don't smoke people come and they were smoking during the meeting. Yeah.
But no, now I think that's perfect. I'm putting that in my back pocket. Now, anytime anyone calls me out on my own personal hypocrisy or my vices, mm-hmm. I'll say, no, I'm bearing witness to the darkness.
There you go.
Just like we are about to bear witness to our own darkness. And perhaps 70 years from now, a historian will say, and then there was Cool Zone Media who said they were against capitalism and yet the advertisements like these ones.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
And we're back. And so this guy, Hobert, he goes around vandalizing cigarette posters with a big K, which stands for conquer cancer.
Oh.
And he went to jail for a couple months for his graffiti against cancer, right? And then when he gets out, he gets a rich sponsor for his... Oh, this is where I should have done it. Oh, well, whatever. And he gets a rich sponsor for his campaign. And so he opens the anti-smoke temple. And then his anti-smoke temple burns down, and I think he did it, and I can't find more information about that, and it annoys me.
It was his Reichstag fire.
It probably, yeah.
Yeah.
I almost had you on. At some point, I'm going to do an episode about how the Reichstag fire was lit by someone who was very earnestly anti-fascist. And just to have a conversation about how complicated certain actions can be. But that's not what we're talking about today. So there was starting to be this culture of happenings, which were big public events that the artsy greasers now starting to move towards hippies would just show up at and do weird shit. And he kind of wound up kicking that off. He had these anti-smoking be-ins that involved an awful lot of him smoking. There's this statue of a little girl on the Spouw, it's the name of a square in Amsterdam. And I used to walk by it every day. And one day, an older punk anarchist who was the first person to tell me about the provost and the Kabouter. And I'll get to the Kabouter later. This statue is called the Little Darling, and it is meant to represent the playful, indefatigable, I don't know how to pronounce that word, spirit of the Dutch youth. But it was donated to the city by a tobacco company. So as soon as Hobert finds that out, he's like, this is where I'm going. This is the center of it all. And it's kind of perfect, right? It's the like playful, youthful spirit of the city. And he goes and that's the whole point of these movements I'm going to talk about, is that they prided themselves on what's called the ludic spirit, the playful spirit that they brought into things. However, his particular method won't look good. Almost every history of this leaves a very important part out. I bet you're going to be able to figure out which part they leave out. Every week, Robert shows up in costume to perform ceremonies and rant against the evils of tobacco
companies.
The Dutch
love blackface. Was he in blackface?
He was in blackface.
Oh.
You win.
If you haven't seen that episode of Atlanta with Donald Glover talking about, just watch it. Just watch it.
Fuck, I've seen the first season of Atlanta, but I don't remember.
This was in like one of the later seasons, and they're like, they're in Europe, and then they go to Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah. No, I would remember.
I think they still do their little, like, Santa's little blackface friend Christmas parades. Yeah.
That's what we're about to talk about, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So, in Dutch tradition, there's Sinterklaas, Santa Claus, St. Nicholas. He's the patron saint of Amsterdam and of sailors and beggars. That's pretty cool. In Dutch form, Santa Claus has an assistant, Zwarte Piet, Black Pete.
Little Black Peter.
Yeah. So Robert puts on blackface every week and goes to rant against consumer culture. He ranted against the asphalt jungle of refrigerators and electric egg beaters. And we've talked some about the Western European tradition of blackface and mummery on this show, about how it, like, in different places does and doesn't have roots in racial stereotypes, but how everyone with any kind of conscience has moved away from it.
Because I think there is some argument, at least from the Dutch, that Schwarze Peter is not in blackface, that he's covered in soot, right? That he's like, it's chimney.
So that's what they've moved to.
That's what they claim. I don't know the real history there.
But he also wears a curly wig and has bright red lipstick.
That's not great.
The best I've been able to figure out is that overall, the Western European tradition of mummery doesn't quite come from racial stereotypes, but plays into them badly. But Zwart Piet seems to be coming from racial stereotypes more completely. And this is a, as you've pointed out, this is a big culture war thing in the Netherlands right now. And so people are talking about Sooty Piet these days.
And I guess if you, you know, if he's doing the smoking thing, you could lean into the soot, but it doesn't sound like
absolutely.
What he was doing.
Yeah. And then it's like, I don't know what this man thought he was doing as relates to this. I don't know whether he's like, oh, Zwart Piet's totally unrelated, but I'm also obsessed with African magic, you know? It's not looking good. But yeah, so these days, more and more people do a soot splotched face instead, and the very distinctly not blackface. And that is good. Hobert did this ceremony every week for a year, and it became kind of his thing. And people would join in and get entranced. Apparently, he was like fairly good at doing these like kind of wild ceremonies. And the magic kind of worked. Other Pliners started doing happenings too, and it sort of spread throughout the city. There's only a little bit of politics in any of this, a general, we don't like consumer society. And then they found a political idea that spoke to them. Anarchism. There were these young anarchists. The one who gets named by history is Roux Vandon, who edited a bunch of papers like The Free and eventually Provo. He and the others were going to these happenings, and he wrote up a pamphlet, and he showed up with the weird ritual with a pamphlet, and it read, Provo feels it must make a choice, desperate revolt or cowering defeat. Provo encourages rebellion wherever it can. Provo knows it must ultimately be the loser, but it cannot miss the chance to thoroughly provoke this society once more. Provo wants to renew anarchism and bring it to the young. And the people were like, yeah, cool, we're in. We didn't like the USSR thing. We don't like the capitalism. This is fucking great. How do we talk? Like, how do we merge our weird-ass art happenings with your anarchism? And so they started a magazine called Provo. It described itself as a monthly sheet for anarchists, provos, beatniks, pliners, scissor grinders, jailbirds, simple Simon Stylites, magicians, pacifists, potato chip chaps, charlatans, philosophers, germ carriers, grand masters of the Queen's horse, happeners, vegetarians, syndicalists, Santa Clauses, kindergarten teachers, agitators, pyromaniacs, assistant assistants, scratchers and syphilitics, secret police and other riffraff. Provo has something against capitalism, communism, fascism, bureaucracy, militarism, professionalism, dogmatism, and authoritarianism.
They've invented several new kinds of guys.
They have so many kinds of guys. You have so many options when you join the Provos.
I mean, potato chip chap sounds good.
I know. Simple Simon Stylites is like a Christian mysticism thing that I had to look up. It's like a guy who sat on top of a pillar because he didn't like talking to people and he wanted to live an ascetic life.
Yeah, a hermit on a big pole.
Yeah, hermit, yeah. Pole hermit.
The cave is better, I think, but stylite works too.
I clearly would go for a mountain in West Virginia. That is where I would actually go to be a hermit. I cannot make any other claim.
Yeah, you chose your choice.
Yeah, clearly it's made
the
decision.
It's too late for you to be a scissor grinder.
I know, although I kind of want to be, but that's unrelated. More of a sapphic. So anyway, so they're tying together weird pacifism, Christian mysticism, anarchism, and the counterculture. The Provos, you will be shocked to know this, was not hierarchical or a membership organization. It was an open movement. The magazine had several thousand subscribers and supporters who sometimes showed up, and then a core of more like 100 people who were like always there at the Provo happenings. And they were anarchists, but they were too anarchist for most of anarchism. They considered the old school anarchists, communists, and socialists and their class struggle obsession as irrelevant in a post-war society. Basically, the betrayal of the Russian Revolution by the Bolsheviks had thrown off the proletarian momentum, as had consumer society and the rise of fascism. Quote, the proletariat of the West has submitted to its political leadership and TV. It has merged with the old bourgeoisie into one large gray rabble of addicted consumers.
Yeah, they kind of got our ass there.
I know, right? And so they wrote a bunch of really interesting, I don't read much theory on this show, but they wrote a bunch of interesting theory about this. And the part that I like for this story is that they coined the term provotariat, which is, quote, "The provotariat is characterized by detachment from the manufacturing process through a psychological protest against manufactured social attitudes. They push for the provotariat of the developed world to join with the hungry proletariat of the developing world and have a worldwide revolution." Basically, they invented Adbusters about 30 years before Adbusters. I don't even know if Adbusters is still around or if it's a...
I mean, he started out, you know, defacing ads, so it makes sense.
Yeah.
He's staying true to his roots.
Yeah. So they also weren't against participation in municipal electoral politics, and this becomes a defining part of their politics. The local Marxists hated the provos because the provos rejected the USSR as much as they rejected capitalism.
Some things never change.
Oh, absolutely. No, this is like, they were like the anti-tanky. It's brilliant. I just like read this and I'm like, yeah, time, flat circle. I get it. You know,
like these guys would have been posting the weirdest fucking memes.
Absolutely. These absolutely would be meme people right now. There was this official student union movement, the SVB, and it was like all proper. I think it was Marxist, Leninist, Maoist. And it was like materialist and it had dull meetings and leaflets. And the SVB called students young intellectual workers who deserved a scholarly salary. And the provos instead went to the students and were like, "You're the provotariat." And the students were like, "Yeah, that sounds way more fun." Like, fuck that.
You guys are having happenings.
I know. Y'all are fucking too. Like, because they're a weird, you know, crazy counterculture. The provos held the only authority that could be respected was the authority built on trust. If leaders weren't worthy of the trust of those that they led, they should step down. So they weren't traditional anarchists even at the start. You know, they honestly, like, I bet you these people would take like one look at the Zapatistas and like the Rochavan movement and been like, that's our fucking jam, you know? But theory wasn't really their thing. Their thing was these happenings. And their thing was also offering and trying out specific solutions to specific problems. Well, and I'll talk about those in a minute. They became active in a number of social struggles. They became active in the protests against the Vietnam War. The Dutch backed the US in that war, but never actually sent any troops. And my inference is that the large protest movement was part of that decision. They were by and large committed pacifists. They were anti-militarist, but also focused their tactics and strategy around non-violently provoking violent reactions from the state to show the violence inherent in the system. Oof.
That's a dark road.
I know. It's also the kind of road where I'm like, I mean, I guess people have tried it in the US, but I'm like, I think people know about the violence inherent in the system here.
I mean, there are plenty of protest movements now in the US whose whole goal is like, look how awful it is that the state is repressing us like this. It's like, yeah, I know. Now you're in jail.
Yeah. When it's a surprise because you're like happy Dutch culture, then it's interesting. I don't know, whatever. I'm not trying to, people who are doing shit, I'm pro people doing shit. I'm not trying
so
to
they
specifically.
Didn't send troops to Vietnam. Like, what is sort of the state of the Netherlands in the 60s, right? Like, had they fully demilitarized after the war? Like, what do they, at what point did their colonies wind down? I should know this, but.
No, and I only know some of this. I know that they lost Indonesia when Japan became the colonial rulers of Indonesia in the mid-1940s during World War II. And that was like a big one. So a lot of the provotariat grew up in Indonesia. And I actually cannot, I get the feeling that the author of most of the text is a little bit like race blind and wouldn't tell me whether or not someone from Indonesia was Indonesian or was like a white person who lived there in a colonial sense. I get the impression both of those things are true. Also, the Dutch absolutely had a military, and I think a lot of their stuff was against conscription. I ended up like halfway down a rabbit hole of figuring out exactly when they did and didn't have conscription, but it like kept changing year to year, and so I didn't finish that rabbit hole.
Yeah, I just feel like the Netherlands was completely left out of my public school education, so I don't know what they were doing.
No, absolutely. I mean, like, I thought it was called Holland, you know? And the other big thing that they were against is the other thing that we had both forgotten was true about them. They really didn't like the monarchy. And the Netherlands still has one of those. Princess Beatrix, later Queen Beatrix, got married in 1966. And so the provost declared that the wedding day would be the day of anarchy.
Oh, hell yes.
Yeah. Their goal was to disrupt the royal wedding and to draw attention to authoritarian government by provoking a reaction so that people could see the iron fist within the velvet glove.
Okay.
And it makes sense when you have all this pageantry around, like, look, here's our beautiful, you know, like, here's the tradition of monarchy.
So this big royal wedding was sort of in the early days of things like this being televised internationally. So this was an opportunity for them to get a lot of attention.
Yep. And specifically the fact that it was television cameras. Yeah, it was a big fucking deal. Because also, I think that overall, the Netherlands got TV a little bit later. Like, I've read about this in a couple other countries where just like, TV is like around and invented, but it doesn't really filter out as quickly as it does in like the United States. But it's by this point a thing, right? And so what they decided to do was mostly they spread rumors about what they were going to do rather than doing these things. They spread rumors that they were going to broadcast the sound of machine gun fire from speakers on the roof of a nearby building.
That's really smart.
I know. And specifically, they said, this is what we're going to do. Not we're going to have machine guns, but we are going to make the noise of machine guns. You know, they also said, you can tell they're getting into being hippies. They said they're going to dose the police horses with acid or just the entire municipal water supply.
What would LSD do to a horse? That's a good question.
I don't know. It'd be bad. Don't maliciously dose anyone. Hippies, you were wrong about the whole... In the U.S., the East Coast and West Coast drug scene had a massive divide about whether or not is if a good way to like turn people on to the revolution by dosing them without asking them.
Yeah, the CIA did that too.
Yeah, I know, right?
So I don't like, know.
And it was the West Coast hippies who were like, "Nah, it's cool to do that." And then it was the East Coast like proto punks, like this group Up Against the Wall motherfucker, who were sort of black leather jacket hippies. They were the ones who were like, you can't fucking take that choice away from people. Fuck you. And I like that. Have you seen the Skeletor meme where it's like Skeletor who's like, let me see if I can do this right. Hippies are bad people pretending to be good people and punks are good people pretending to be bad people. That's how I feel about that divide. It's not how I feel about the Netherlands. These are good hippies I'm talking about by and large. But they claim that they're going to do it to provoke a reaction.
But that's so smart because you don't even have to really do anything because the cops are just thrown into confusion.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure some of them reacted as though they'd been dosed regardless.
Oh my God, you're probably right.
The first fentanyl scare.
And they all died.
The cops are just laying in the streets, hyperventilating.
Yeah.
Tearing off their clothes.
Much like, are we sponsored by fentanyl? No. No. Well, whatever we're sponsored by, snort it.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this.
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global. Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today
at purdueglobal.edu.
And we're back. The other thing that they actually did do, and that they said they were going to do and then did do, is throw orange paint bombs and like smoke bombs and shit.
It's the color of their monarchy, right?
Yes, exactly. The ruling dynasty is the House of Orange-Nassau.
Oh.
And what they ended up having was kind of a classic 1966 protest. Lots of people showed up and cops beat everyone up. Smoke bombs obscured the royal carriage from being seen by the TVs. And so they absolutely fucked up the royal wedding as a media spectacle. As a result of, I think, this action, I think, both the mayor and the chief of police end up stepping down. And that was
that's an international humiliation.
Yeah.
You couldn't control your hippies.
Yeah. And so when it was just good old fashioned racist happenings at the Spau, the cops let people do things. But now that they're the provost, the cops come and fuck that up. And so every week, the provost show up and have these happenings. And every week, the cops come and fuck with it. And this starts polarizing Dutch society pretty hard. It wins over a huge chunk of people towards their cause. But 37% of the Dutch population believed the provost belonged in prison.
Yeah.
There was also this working class youth gang tension. Here we get in the real sharks versus jets. Between the provos and this group called the CS, the Central Station Youth, who are more like, I would use this word oogles, but no one knows what I mean when I say that. They were like the street kids. They were like runaways and
like little Dutch crust punks.
Yeah, they were the proto Dutch crust punks. And they hung out at Central Station. And occasionally the provos and the CS kids would fight. Occasionally they would make alliances. At one point, the CS kids burned down the provost's houseboat. But in proper Hollywood fashion, the two groups joined up together when they had a common enemy. And this is where I would put, this would be an important scene in the movie if I were making this. There was a right-wing youth culture called the military.
Like the actual military?
The actual military.
Oh,
yeah,
okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say, is that like a cool right-wing street gang? They just called themselves? No, it's like the actual military.
No, yeah. Like, yeah. They actually have some courage, unlike the right wing in the United States that needs to just pretend like they're in a military. Anyway, so these sailors, they were called the Janchas, the little Jans. They wanted to rid Central Station of the long-haired work-shy scum. That was like the words that they were using, like long hair. There was like magazines and shit, like fight for your right to have long hair as a boy. And they were work-shy, which is true. Fuck work, whatever.
They weren't shy about it.
Yeah, it's true. Totally. They're willing to throw down about it, actually. So a crew of 100 Marines and sailors, maybe it actually is just sailors and it's just a way that it got translated. They try to drive the CS kids out of Central Station and the provost show up and they all throw down together and they drive the military guys out. So these anarcho-pacifists who won't fight cops, but are like, well, we're going to fight these fucking right-wing people who are beating up our friends.
Only we can pick on the little kid gang.
Yeah, exactly. We'll fight them, not you. This did not recruit the CS kids to like join the movement, but it's still fucking cool. And so them being active in the streets was cool. But it's like, that's kind of par for the course for being a 60s, you know, primarily youth movement, right? What really makes them stand out are their proposals and actions for a better world. They called them their white plans. They picked white because it's a symbol of pacifism.
Okay.
Once again, I'm going to say a bunch of names of plans that don't translate well into English.
So it just doesn't have a great flavor in English, but I get it.
No, yeah, especially once we start talking about the white children and the white women. It's going to look bad. I've read the claim that they basically created the modern environmental movement. That is not really true, but certainly in the Netherlands, they were among the first to openly talk about and take seriously the idea of pollution. And they were a heavy part of invigorating an environmental movement world in the West. The actual roots of the modern environmental movement are more nebulous and a little bit less Western.
Although I guess once sea level rise was a concept people understood, it was very fucking real for the Netherlands.
Yeah, totally.
Because they're not going to be there anymore.
Yeah, I've read some, at least one. Whenever you read like a climate fiction book, that's like at a macro level. It's like, and then the Netherlands has to figure out how to, you know, because, oh yeah, I forgot to say context wise. Most of the Netherlands is below sea level.
Yeah, it's the Miami of Europe.
Yeah. And so one of their core arguments of the provosts, and one of their big things they're fighting for forever, is they want a car-free downtown Amsterdam. They're like, bikes and people, yes, cars, no. Their most famous innovation out of this is the white bicycle program. They declared that the city should close to cars and that 20,000 white bicycles should be left around the city for anyone to use. Ride it for a while, then leave it where you're done when you're done for the next person to use. Decades later, the all-devouring maw of capitalism has taken this idea and sold it back to people as the city bike and scooter plans, and even like rideshare cars actually come directly, like you can trace the lineage from the anarcho-pacifist Christian mystics.
That's hideous. They made it so ugly. They made it so ugly.
What have they done to my boy?
They massacred my boy.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, yeah. So the provosts are credited as the originators of the modern bike and car share system, but it was supposed to be free. And they started the program by just doing it.
Just putting a bike out.
Yeah, they just gathered in public and painted bikes white and then passed out leaflets explaining the whole concept. The leaflet read in classic Provo form, "Daily sacrifices are made for that newest authority that the crowd have submitted themselves to. The car equals authority. Suffocating carbon monoxide is its incense. Its image has ruined thousandfold streets and canals."
God, I feel like you could do this right now.
Absolutely.
It feels very modern.
Absolutely. I kept running across over and over again with these folks that I'm like, oh, they're ahead of their time. I mean, if they hadn't been ahead of their time, if they just succeeded, we'd be in a much better situation. In the end, almost every version I've read, when like people talk about the white bikes program, they're like, oh, well, like they kind of just got stolen or thrown in the canal, you know, like, oh, tragedy of the commons, right? Cops stole most of the white bikes.
Shocking.
It was illegal to leave bikes unlocked in the Netherlands at that point. And if this isn't the most cop brain shit in the world, I'd better steal your bike so that you don't leave it around for someone to steal.
They're preventing crime by doing it themselves.
Exactly.
That's why they do most of the drug trafficking.
Yeah, exactly. Except that one drug that if they get anywhere near, sponsor of the... Why am I being an edgelord today? All right, anyway. The founder of this plan is this guy named Luge Schimmelpennig, and he's from a lefty Catholic family. In the end, like a lot of the provosts and later Kabouters, he stayed involved in local government after all of this stuff is over and basically still, I think he's alive, spends his days trying to alleviate traffic problems in the Netherlands. The bikes weren't the only solution to the car problem. They had another program, the name of which does not translate well. It's called the White Body Program.
Okay.
Again, you know, whatever. Anyway, anyone who's killed by a car, their outline would be chalked onto the street, and then the silhouette would be carved out and forever filled with white mortar.
Wait, is this, I mean, maybe this has like an entirely separate origin, but in the US, when a cyclist is killed by a car, they leave like a ghost bike. Are these things related?
Yep.
Fascinating.
I spent a while down that particular rabbit hole. That program, the ghost bike program, started in 2003 in St. Louis, and I am not the only one who has traced its history back to the provosts.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And that same bike culture of like early 2003, like counterculture, was very aware of the white bike program. I heard about the white bike program way more often than I ever heard about the provosts themselves. They also fought for this thing that happens now in urban development. They fought for play streets. The idea of just taking streets and turning them into permanent public space. The way that they conceived of them, they would have like free machines, like I think it's like washing machines and shit, as well as phones and such for anyone who didn't have such things at home. Like the phone would have like a really, really long extension cord, you know, so that you could like come out to the street, grab the phone. If you need to go talk, you go talk and then bring it back, you know, so that anyone who doesn't have these things at home can use it. By the late 60s, the government actually started, this is one of the ones they kind of won. And the government started like kind of working with them and allowing this to happen in more places. And I still know anarchists who are involved in making this kind of thing happen today. A friend of mine got a play street under that name, a play street for her neighborhood in Queens.
That's incredible. So they closed the street off to cars and
and now it's a public space.
That's beautiful. There was a little bit of movement on that, I think, during the pandemic, right? Like where they were moving like cafe space into what used to be a street for cars, but I don't think it really stuck anywhere in the US.
Yeah. I feel like I still see that sometimes in cities, but I don't know. I don't go into cities enough to really be sure. I like them. I'm not anti them. Okay. One of my favorite programs of theirs. This one did not take off. It's called their White Chicken Plan. Chicken is slang for cop. It's like comparable to pigs. When I was there, we mostly called them klotzak, which means ball sack. But at the time, it was chicken. It's one of the first Dutch words they learned. So the White Chicken program, basically cops, instead of driving around locking people up, should bicycle around with pockets full of sandwiches and fruit to give out to the needy.
So true.
Yeah. And I would just argue this didn't take off. I have read a more moderate / progressive position that this actually did have a fairly large influence on the way that policing was conceived of in the Netherlands as cops as social workers. But it didn't stop cops from going around doing bad stuff. So I feel like in some ways that's the problem with most attempts to reform the police.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it would be nice if you just made a separate group of guys who did that rather than trying to get the cops to do something, because that's just confusing for them. Like, I wouldn't take a snack from a cop.
I know. Rewires their brain. And yeah. Then they had their White Chimney Plan, which was to paint all of the chimneys of major polluters white so everyone knew what they were doing to the world. Like a name and shame kind of thing.
I'm with that.
Yeah, no. I like basically all their plans. Like, not all of them are perfect. They were anti-monogamy, but I don't believe they had a white orgy plan, fortunately. On feminism, they were pretty 1960s about it, which is to say they were actively engaged in the fight for women's rights, all the while doing a sexism. One of their things was the promotion of the provosexual, which was basically that hot Provo ladies should seduce people into their movement and or just like seduce bad people to like go seduce the cops, not fuck so them, but like
they're doing like flirty fishing for anarchism.
Yeah.
Okay.
If people decide that that's what they want to do, I have no problem inherently with that, you know? Then you get into the ones that really don't translate well. I'll just, whatever, this made my point. They had the White Women Plan. One provo, Irene van den Wittering, wrote up a white plan for providing sex and contraceptive education for women and girls. White plan is the name of these plans, right? They'd write it up. And so basically it was like sex ed and contraceptive education for women and girls. That's what we need. And then they had their White Children Plan, which was collective nurseries and education along anarchist lines. Five couples with children would pool childbearing and babysitting duties. So basically, like, every parent of the 10 parents would take a week looking after all the kids in the nursery so that everyone had more time to do things besides just raising kids. But the kids always had an attentive caregiver. It takes a village to raise a child, and it was cool. It only works if none of the 10 parents have a regular job. And they hoped that neighbors would like send their kids to come get looked after by the anarchist nurseries, and the neighbors weren't doing it.
They were on the cutting edge of abolition of the family.
Yeah. They had a White House plan, which was that empty homes should be refurnished for housing and offices and city centers should be turned into housing. No houses should be demolished until everyone is housed. So they would always have their like, this is what society should do, and then here's like what we're going to do directly, you know? And what they did directly was kind of start the squatter movement. They broke into empty buildings and fixed them up with plumbing and electrical so that families could move in and live for free. There was this very major housing crisis for decades in the Netherlands following the war. And this was one of their ways of addressing that directly.
Was there a lot of like physical destruction in the Netherlands during the war? Like, did they lose a lot of housing stock to war damage?
You know, it's funny. And if people want to know more about it beyond what my memory can summon up, I did an episode about about the Dutch squatting movement with a Dutch squatter who runs a podcast that you can go back and listen to. I know that some cities like Rotterdam were completely leveled and rebuilt after the war. I believe Amsterdam was not damaged as badly. And I think that, the housing shortage was more caused by housing speculation.
Okay. So did they like have their own post-war baby boom, but it wasn't accompanied by, like, I don't know, in America, we invented the suburbs at this point.
Yeah, well, in this case, it's like houses that were empty when the economy is bad, it's like cheaper to not let them out to anyone as to rent and just like hold on to them and wait for the economy to get better. And they're also doing a lot of like urban development. Like the Amsterdam developed as a city that was had a residential core, and then it became more of a commercial core. But then there's like people who are trying to live there, and then there's not enough housing.
So they fixed that.
Yeah. And actually, it to the point where eventually the Netherlands legalized squatting because even the government had to admit it was a social good until I think it was 2011 when capitalism succeeded it.
Wow. If only there was a lot of like empty commercial real estate in someone else's country.
Yeah. I would actively tell people that squatting is a very good social thing to do. And if you do it if you build it up as a movement, you can defend each other and you can do things like not have squatting be a way of expecting people to live in squalor, but instead live very well. I lived in a squatted mansion owned by a mafia boss.
That's beautiful.
Because if you leave a building for when squatting was legal in the Netherlands, if the building was empty for a year and you didn't have proof that you were in the process of renovating it into some purpose, people could legally break in and live there. So this mafia dude was in jail. So he wasn't doing anything with his fucking mansion. It was a row home, but it was this mansion of a house right in downtown. So squatters moved in and lived there. And every now and then mafia guys would come and like be like, hey, you should really move out of here. But like the squatters in the Netherlands were like, nah, we're good. Fucking bring it. Because they're fucking tough as shit. And they were not pacifist by the time I was there. Anyway, that's beside the point. The pacifists, they called what they were doing the gentle revolution or sweet revolution or smart evolution. And it was pretty fucking cool. They got into some trouble at the very beginning. The first issue of Provo, it had been made by all these like very I come from anarchy specifically. So it had like obsolete bomb recipes from 1910 in the first issue, and it got confiscated. And they would get arrested for all kinds of shit though. And I feel like these show the character of the movement. The one woman, Kostja Koster, was arrested for giving out dried currants while preaching charity, which I believe is a specific Bible reference that is above my head. Another guy, Hans Thunmann, he got himself sentenced to a few months in prison for muttering imagine over and over again. And I can't figure out how. I don't know what happened.
What
and
was
I'm
the
annoyed.
Crime?
I don't know. And I'm so annoyed. Maybe he like went up to cops and just saying it over. I don't know.
And maybe he was being menacing about it.
Yeah. He wrote a book about his time in jail, which if I had more time in my life and I had found a translation of Full Time Provo, the book he wrote in jail, then I probably would have been able to figure out what he was arrested for. It sold well enough that it bought him a riverboat. I believe this is the one that the CS kids burned down.
Oh, not his jail memoir riverboat.
I know. But I think they had a bunch of riverboats by the end. So I'm not sure. They believed in municipal autonomy. They believed that city decision-making should be done at the lowest possible level with neighborhood councils and then a larger municipal council only as like the way that government happens in society. And so since they believed in neighborhood and municipal councils, these anarchists started running for city government. This took ideological reconciling, but not a ton. As they put it, they were not ideologically committed. They were ideologically inspired. Which, like, I'm not saying one way or the other about what tactics make sense, but that is a better way to look at ideology. Their campaign motto was "Vote Provo, have fun," which is,
oh, yeah,
yeah,
short and sweet.
Yeah, they put together a slate of 12 candidates, and the night before the election, Provo 12 was painted all over the city. They got 13,000 votes, which was enough to put one of their candidates onto the Amsterdam Municipal Council, the bigger city council. It was way less than they'd hoped. When you live in a bubble and everyone you know supports you, you think everyone else does too. But the voting age at the time, according to the history book I read, the voting age was 23, but according to every internet source I found, the voting age was 21. The voting age was not 18 at the time. And that's a pretty good turnout.
None of those child gangs could even vote for them.
Exactly. Entering politics wound up divisive. The one guy they elected started getting shit from his friends who were mad at him for like getting too big for his britches.
Classic
and
anarchism.
Meanwhile, everyone else in the council just opposed him at every turn. This poor fucking guy.
Just catching it from all sides.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
He leaves after a few months, but the seats are not by candidate. The seats are by party.
Oh, so they can just fill his seat.
So another provost steps in, and then a third, and then a fourth. And people started complaining about the divide between street provosts and intellectual provosts. Meanwhile, provosts spread across Western Europe, mostly to various Dutch cities, but also to Belgium, West Germany, and Sweden. In November 1966, they held an international provost festival. Beforehand, they did a mass washing of each other's feet in a reference to basically like Christ the anarchist socialist. There's a Super Bowl ad about this shit.
So they are very Christian in their foundation.
They are clearly influenced by Christian theology and Christian pacifism. One of the problems that I run across again and again in history is that when people write histories of leftist movements, they are atheists who write these histories. And I have a hard time finding what religion meant to the participants.
Because that's such an interesting question, right? That, you know, because like you were saying, these sort of political movements are often sort of removed from that context. But it sounds like these people were, I mean, I don't know, in their own words, like very inspired by the actual advice that Christ gave them, right? That they were
absolutely
making sure that everyone had a home and was fed and was cared for. And
yes,
you know, the least among us.
I absolutely believe that meant a lot to at least many of them, if not most of them.
I mean, you're not washing feet for shits and giggles. That's not a bit.
No. This is like, we are anarcho-Christians. That is what they're signifying. Or at least, I mean, a lot of them are Jews, right? But like, they are like, specifically being like, this is not a materialist and atheist movement. There's actually, in the later one, there's going to be this thing where the atheists like, kind of like, barge in with fedoras and are like, Reddit told me that you're not allowed to believe in God. And they basically like, got run out. And like, I find it so fascinating. There are these two big alternative magazines for youth culture at the time. One's called Hit Week and one's called Aloha. And they both promote long hair. These are the magazines that are like advice about how to make your teachers let you have long hair and stuff, you know? And they're all about sex education and they're all about anarchism. The provosts are writing these popular magazines by the end, including that anarchist on city council. He's writing articles about anarchism and also what's going on in local government from his position in the council. That is now in the magazine. Is like,
oh, that rocks.
Yeah. And this culture is spreading too. And then they all quit. On 13th of May, 1967, they publicly announced the abolition of provo after 2 years of being provos. They decided that it had lost its character of spontaneity. It was gaining public support, and its ideas continued to influence everything in Dutch culture. At this point, there's clergymen, artists, and some politicians who are speaking about the wonders of the provosts. But there's also like a tourist bus that will drive people to see and argue with the real provosts. And it had become too predictable, and it had lost its spirit. So they abolished themselves. They still had a city council seat, and so they continued to fill that and continued to do that work. But once they were abolished, they kept going.
Of course they did.
And then they became gnomes. And we're going to talk about them as gnomes on Wednesday.
Oh, I can't wait to hear about the gnomes.
I know. This is one of my, usually the cliffhanger is like, and then they're literally hanging from a cliff and the bomb is about to go off or whatever the fuck. But I'm pretty excited about it. And then they all turned into gnomes. But before we get to that, we should talk about you, and we should talk about the stuff that you do. Is there any new podcasts that people can hear you on, or is there any other work you want to draw attention to?
Yeah, I guess this is coming out soon, right? So I'm having a brief stint right now, guest hosting on It Could Happen Here. So about once a week, you can check me out over there. You can always find me on Twitter at Socialist Dog Mom. We don't have any anarchist city council members, but I do cover our city council. And that's it for me.
Hell yeah. I want to plug that Cool Zone Media has a new podcast, and hold on, it's called Better Offline. I spent like 2 hours listening to it today. I should know the name of it. It's good. It's a tech podcast, but it's a tech podcast that's called Better Offline, which helps you understand where it's coming from. Sophie, what do you got to plug?
Just at Cool Zone Media on the social meds.
And, hell yeah.
If you have a pet it.
Yeah. There's not that many nouns where the verb, actually, there's probably a lot. Never mind. See you Wednesday.
Bye.
Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit RightRug.com, that's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.